Thank you very much, Noel. And it is indeed very good to be here. And I am delighted, and thank you for your invitation. It's a great privilege. My job at the moment is actually leading, supporting, working with governments and other agencies on educational reform. So clearly that has taken me into developing my interest in innovation and the relationship of evidence. I'm actually this afternoon going to take quite a wide view. I actually am going to look at innovation as well as evidence because I actually think that they are inextricably linked. And these are huge debates. So we live in a time of change, whether it's innovation or whether it's reform or what the impact of that is one dimension I want to explore. But when I woke up this morning, I started thinking about this talk, and I started thinking about when I was a student teacher back in the 1970s. And I remembered I could list two or three books to myself that I read that were written by teacher educators, contemporary at that time, that had inspired me. And they were highly innovative. For example, there was a woman called Charity James who worked at Goldsmiths College who was doing great work on curriculum and learning and so on and so forth. And I tried to think today, so what would be the books if I was a student teacher written by teacher educators that would inspire me? Now, it's not my prime territory, so I ask you that question, maybe, to answer that question. But I want to focus on the third quotation on here, which is, education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. And many of the countries I work in believe this passionately. Not only do they believe it passionately, but they're putting it into action. And they are really trying to innovate. So I really want to focus on the word innovation as well as the words evidence-informed innovation. So these are the questions I've taken to drive what I'm thinking today. Let's think about what actually does stimulate innovation and change. What are the beliefs that people, that you can, in a sense, detect from our current policy climate, particularly the one over the water? What innovations have we actually seen? We've seen changes, but what innovations have we actually seen? And what are the unintended consequences of some of that? What's the evidence base for these changes and how is it created? And where and how are the people in the system reacting to this? So, and then hopefully some conclusions that I hope you'll find useful or that perhaps you'll generate yourself as we go along. So, what sort of things do we know stimulate change and innovation? Well, we know firstly, it's a willingness to see things differently and to talk about it. I happen to be lucky enough at the moment to be in a university where that is the prime driver, basically. That is what people do every day. And one of the most memorable stories for me is of a science lecturer at Cambridge called Jane Abercrombie, who trained her scientists by putting them on a group training course, because what she was doing was making them challenge the social assumptions they make, the way in which they make judgments. So she didn't teach them science, she taught them social process, she taught them group dynamics, she taught them how to think about themselves. It's a wonderful little book called The Anatomy of Judgment. And Jane Abercrombie, I think, was doing something very, very important. She was recognizing that good knowledge, good science, good evidence is deeply rooted in social processes. It's deeply rooted in context. It's deeply rooted in where we are. And I want to really explore what the context in education looks like at the moment. It is about building on the shoulders of giants. It is about collecting evidence, adding to the stock of knowledge, adding to what we know about things. And I think that is part of what innovation is about. And I'll talk more about that. And Viv, I guess, will talk more about this, but we need leadership that values difference and challenge. That's not what I see at the moment. I have to say, as a leader of a department and now leader of a much smaller team, it's hard, and that's not the push for leaders. The push is towards, and I'll come back to this, it seems to me, towards standardization, towards accountability, and in many ways, towards conformity. So the other thing that we know breeds innovation and change is collaboration. It's very hard to test your thinking on yourself. It's very hard to see something differently all on your own. And I'll come back later to, I want to show you at the end of today, something that's become known as the Cambridge Cluster. It's an innovation hub. I won't say it's nothing to do with the university, but it's actually spun off from the university, and it's individuals. And the characteristic of that is collaboration and teamwork and innovation. The next thing we need, if we are going to innovate, is we need spaces to innovate in. And if you're going to innovate, if I jump to the bottom, those spaces have to be spaces where you can experiment, where you can take risks, and where you can, in fact, fail, actually. So we need to think about the spaces for work, the spaces for us to think, to work differently, to see things differently. What opportunities do we actually have for that? And I do think that if we are actually going to bring about innovation change, you do actually need to know something. You need to know, if you're going to lead innovation, you need to have a very good knowledge of people, systems, and how change happens, and how people respond to change. And also, you need to know something about the content of what you're working on. And actually, in the world of mega consultancy that I now live in, sometimes that isn't there. And I want to, as Noel has said, argue for the expert in many ways, and for expertise. Okay, I'm just going to pause there, and I do this when I speak, just give you a chance to break and think. So I'm going to give you literally 1 minute with the person next to you. Anything that sparked in you, 1 minute. Okay, so I guess none of that was rocket science to you, and I think you probably know that. So let's look at how this knowledge thing and this innovation thing and this evidence thing relate together. This is, again, not rocket science. It's I just also need to say that I will put this presentation up for you on the website so you can use it and see it, and you don't have to take other than your own thoughts, notes. So this is a classic scaling up of innovation model. Somebody has an idea. Somebody wants to create something new. And so probably at that stage, you need minimal objective evidence. In fact, sometimes there isn't any evidence. There's just an idea that if you put this with that, or we do it this way, you may have an example of one that you're working on at that point. And then you see it as a promising practice. You may start looking around, hearing that maybe you've heard it from somewhere else, maybe this is a promising idea. And then you take it a step further and you start to create some sort of model, working model, and you might have some positive evidence in a few cases. And then you start to build that innovation into practice, and it becomes, it may not become, but you may, if you're lucky, turn it into a good practice, and you have evidence from several cases. And then finally, you may have to up the ante on the evidence if you're going to try and persuade other people that this is a good idea to join in. So you go from good practice to best practice by collecting more evidence. And then it becomes policy. Now, this is an ideal model. Those of you who live in England who see the way in which policy develops, it doesn't often bear a relationship to that process, but sometimes it does. Sometimes it does. And I'll come back to that. So what I want to say is that if you look at the black line underneath, innovation is not constrained by evidence. It shouldn't be. It should be, at the beginning, it should be about newness, difference, creation, creativity. But if you're going to go all the way to best practice, never mind policy, then the evidence demand increases. But you need very different sorts of evidence. And I want you to hold on to this diagram because I think you need very different sorts of evidence at different times in this process. And we, I think, have fallen, I think in the UK, in England, we've definitely fallen into the trap of thinking that there's only one preferred form of evidence. And I'm going to try to show you in the sorts of evidence that I've chosen today that I think we need to collect different sorts of evidence. And the words I would write at the top of this would be fitness for purpose. And so first you have to have a purpose. And first you have to say, what are we trying to do in this innovation? Where is it trying to go? Does it matter, for example, what impact it has on the people in the system? Or is student outcomes or raises in student attainment the only thing that matters? So that suggests to us that there is a relationship, a strong relationship between innovation and practice as we scale it up, and that the evidence demands are very different. Okay, so I put this up before. We talked about the climate for innovation and change. I want to explore our current policy climate, the one that I work in anyway. This is not rocket science, this is not new, but let's remind ourselves what the basic assumptions are underpinning the changes that have been made in many cases in the English system. First, there is no secret that it is a market-based approach, what's called in many places a neoliberal framework. And it's based on the idea that if you market things, if you create a market, things will improve. So the marketization of this. And this started in our system back in England in 1988 with the Education Reform Act. Accountability. I don't need to explain that one to you. increasing deregulation of some things, for example, teacher education. In fact, you will remember that at one time, there was the idea that there should be no regulation of teacher education, that teachers in England should not need qualifications at all. It was one idea that was put forward and never got that far. Autonomy, that in fact autonomy of schools from local authorities, autonomy of head teachers to behave and act in ways they wanted was a driver for improvement. Competition. So it wasn't actually originally the 1988 Education Reform Act that introduced competition, but there was the introduction of league tables as a side on it, a side to the Act, which in fact created the dynamic of competition between schools and comparison between schools. And now, of course, we're driven by very different international league tables. And there was the notion of standards, and many academics have written how standards became standardization. And they're not the same thing at all. There is a rhetoric, and I'll come back to this, there is a rhetoric of evidence-informed policy. There is a rhetoric that all policy is evidence-informed. And there is a lot of talk of measurement and micro-measurement. English schools, you know, micro-analyze everything. They do subgroups within a class. They do extraordinary measurements. What underpinning this is the view of people. Those of you who are old enough will remember Theory X and Theory Y. And I can't remember which way around they were. But one theory is basically a theory of human nature which says people only work if they get rewarded. Otherwise, you can't change behavior. It's very simply put. Theory Y was people work in response to enjoyment and responsibility. So people will take responsibility, says Theory X, if you pay them more. So if you need schools to be well-led, you have to have super teachers, super head teachers, who are paid an extraordinary amount of money. Theory Y says, no, you give people responsibility and they will respond to that. You give them autonomy and responsibility. So these are very different views of human nature and change and how and why people change. So the market-based approach largely says people respond to striving and competition and that rewards shape behavior, rewards for schools, and that change has to be driven and is not a natural process. So that's a set of assumptions that underpin, I think, our current view of change and how it's being operated. Okay, let me pause there. You might want to disagree with me, but perhaps you say that to the person next to you. So 1 minute, just to share ideas of where we are now. Your responses. Okay. So what I don't want to do is turn this into a yaboo debate. I don't want to say, look at this list, everything on it is bad. Because actually, if we look at this list, two of the things on that list I can see come out as prime drivers of innovation. One is autonomy, and the other is choice. So it's not a yaboo debate, but these are very different models, and I'm going to do that by trying to develop with you, I'm going to pick two examples, the two that are in red. So what recent systemic innovations have occurred in England? Well, academies. Academies based on the notion of choice. Now, I happen to be a governor, actually, of a school when this idea was mooted. They weren't called academies. I'm trying to remember what they were called. Trusts. And if you actually, I think it's very interesting. My take on how this was introduced was through finance. So what happened to schools at that time? There were cuts. And it was promised that schools would not be cut, that education budgets would not be cut. And in fact, some parts of the education budgets for schools were not cut, but some parts were cut. And in the school that I was a governor of, the head teacher was in a position where she, it was a large secondary school, where she started to become concerned about whether she'd be able to cover salaries every month. So it was quite significant. At the time, when people, the response to becoming a trust was very slow and very small. And then the government introduced a £50,000, or I can't even remember, it was 50 or 500. Anyway, large sum of money. Incentive to become a trust. And in the end, the school that I was a governor of went for it because they needed to, actually. So sometimes various models of reward are used to introduce change. And I would argue that the academies have done that. I've just read a recent economic evaluation, actually, of academies, just come out this month, and I've forgotten the title of the document, but I will give it to you, anybody who wants it, which is evaluating the success of them or not. And it's argued, actually, that they have not been successful, that because there has been a tension between control and choice and autonomy, and that, in fact, the desire to control the reform, the standardization agenda that we were looking at before, has actually stopped the development of a really free market and real choice for schools to do what they like. So we've had academies. We've had competition between schools. And of course, what we know is that in that competition, some schools have done better than others, much better than others. And in fact, now some of the academies and the trusts are running into problems. The schools that are the weaker ones. We have, I don't know whether you'd call inspection innovation now, because it's been there a long time, but a very different system of inspection from HMI, which was a very school development focused inspection, to an accountability model of inspection. Testing, don't need to tell you about that. A real agenda to try to raise the gap in attainment, and a real agenda to raise standards. And one of the examples of that was the London Challenge, which I'm going to focus on in a minute. And big curriculum changes. So there's been a lot of change in the agenda. And I guess one of the questions I would want to raise is it innovation or is it change? What counts for the difference between efficiency gains a system constantly trying to refine itself, and real innovation. And we'll come back to that. So what have been some of the impacts of these innovations? Well, unfortunately, and this is not just an English or a UK problem, it's now a global problem, we have mirrored in the economic profile of our societies continuing increase in inequalities in outcome and access. That is not going away. It won't go away. It has become the sticky problem, if you like. And what is now beginning to be questioned is what drove the Academy's agenda in many ways at the beginning was that this would be better for vulnerable pupils. It would be ways of giving vulnerable pupils a higher standard of education. And that is now being questioned. And I'm going to show you some recent data on exclusions for schools, which I find quite horrifying, actually. We've also had some, I think, very good models of school improvement with strong results. And I guess the classic one is the London Challenge. I don't know if you've heard of this, but if you haven't, it's very well worth going and looking. London schools used to be the worst schools in the country with the worst results. There was a program of school improvement, which I'm going to talk about in some depth, which is, well, question mark, did it result or was it other things that resulted? But the outcome is that London schools are now the best schools in the country with the highest attainment. Some of the other impacts, I think, is that we have got used to evidence. We've got used to and we demand evidence on certain topics. For example, issues around bullying or certain other key issues. Now, the use of evidence is now commonplace. And we use it for school development and we also use it to make in terms of research. But I think there are some real problems with the people in the system at the moment. Teachers, students, and the way in England that education is talked about is now a bit of a problem. It's constantly talked about as though it's a problem. I was having some informal conversations before this talk with others, and it feels as though you haven't lost that yet here. You've got quite a high valuing of teaching, quite a high valuing of education. Okay. What has been the impact of the current model on people? I'm going to jump ahead and then come back to this. Well, this is an extract from a national newspaper, 20th of July, 2017. The number of children expelled, not just temporarily excluded, but permanently excluded, from English schools hits 35 a day. The number of permanent exclusions from schools in England has gone up with the equivalent of 35 children being expelled every school day, according to government figures. Almost 6,700 children were permanently excluded from school, primary, secondary and special, in 2015-16, that's the late figures. So here's the graph, if you like. So the middle grey is all pupils, the bottom is primary, and the top is secondary. Now, I happen to have been following, because I just have an academic interest, if you like, in school exclusions. The rise began in 1990. 1988 was the introduction of the Education Reform Act and the introduction of competition between schools. There was a 400% increase in exclusions from primary school 2 years after that. I think you could justify the hypothesis that what we've done in the system is make certain sorts of students unattractive. They're undesirable because they take up time, attention, and so on. You could say, and many do, that it's because students are more misbehaved. They don't behave as well as they do, that society has changed, and so on. But we are now living with a level in which, if you like, the idea of the common school is, I think, something that needs to be discussed. Is this a school for everybody? What are the conditions of innovation and change doing to the people in those systems? We've got problems with the staff, with teachers in England. There is, in terms of schools, a drive for survival. And as part of that, a risk aversion, I would argue. Many of the changes that are introduced are not evidenced, actually. They're ideological. I'm not surprised by that. Policy changes have never been based on evidence. Politicians do not make primary judgments about policy based on evidence. They do have to look at evidence if it's clearly demonstrated that it's not working. And I think the recent debate about grammar schools in England was an example of that, where the evidence won out, actually. We're starting to see tension between aims, and this is this economic report I was talking about, which says there is now big tension between autonomy and control in the system. And it's actually stopping innovation and change, even if you agree with that model of change. We see huge issues around staff retention. Low satisfaction from staff, low satisfaction from students. If you look at things like the Innocenti report or well-being scales, you'll see that English students consistently are less satisfied with school than others and report higher levels of being pressured at school. And so we see constant shifts in policy. This is something called the hype cycle. It's about reform and change. And you see a cycle where there's an innovation, and this is a fairly predictable process. Expectations go really, really high. And then when reality hits, especially as you scale it up, and it starts to encounter problems, you see what's called the trough of disillusionment. And I think it's at this point that many people jump ship, politicians jump ship and drop it. So then many innovations are not allowed to carry through. We live in a climate in which there is constant change. So the people in our systems, I think, are struggling with the model of change, as well as with the load of change, the load that is being put on them in terms of change. Okay, let me pause there. So that bit chunk was about the people in the systems and the change and how we help or support people during times of innovation and change. Would you like to share a minute with your partner? Okay. Now, I'm not out to depress you. Well, you may be feeling a little in that trough of disillusionment at the minute, but I hope to raise you up to the slopes of enlightenment in a minute. But I think what I'm trying to say is we know there are conditions around which innovation thrives. I don't think we're working in a model at the moment that allows for that. We're working in a model of change, which I don't think is breeding innovation. I think it's a model of controlled change, much of which is often incoherent at times. And that if you are going to have change, you are going to have innovation, you have to care about the people. So when we talk about what evidence do we collect, I think we need to be collecting evidence about the people in the system or the impact of the system on the people. That matters as much as the impact of what it's having on student attainment. So we need a wide scale of evidence. And we're not putting these evidence bases, I think, alongside each other. Okay. I want to argue for innovation now. I want to argue that we desperately need innovation in education at the moment. The young people who we're educating for are not going to live the world in which I lived. I think the world is... I'm not depressed about it. There are some things that are not very cheerful at the moment. We're going through a bad patch globally. But I think we need to look at how have we, in the last 20 years, really innovated. So I turned to this. I don't know how many of you've heard of this, but it's something that actually incenses me. It's in the OECD framework for the curriculum for the 21st century. In fact, it is the whole rationale for the new curriculum that the world should be taking on. What this argument is that we live in a VUCA world. It is volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. So I tracked down this concept of VUCA. Do you know where it comes from? The American Army. It was the American Army's assessment of Afghanistan during the context of Afghanistan during the war. Well, I don't think that's a very good framework for a curriculum myself, but you may disagree with me. But what struck me about this is a very pessimistic, problem-driven view of the world. And it's not a world which allows for any shaping by the young people in it. So this quotation, a shallow educational response to social change, is actually a phrase of Nell Nodding's in her latest book. And I was really taken by that phrase. I thought, how are we as educators? I go back to where I started. How are we as teacher educators responding to creating innovation that is really going to help young people to live in schools and have experiences educationally that are going to really prepare them not for a VUCA world? I mean, obviously, some of that is around. It is a complex world we live in. And at times I do feel quite ambiguous about what's going on, and there is complexity. But it seems to me that we're being increasingly driven by a problem-framed and problem-driven analysis, both of education and what education is for, that it's programmatic and fragmented. I attended an event last week in Cambridge. I don't know how many of you have heard of a company called Arm. Arm makes microchips. If any of you own an Apple product, it will be driven by Arm microchips. Arm has become one of the biggest companies in the world. It's one of the spin-off companies, if you like, from the university. And they financed and held the most, I have to say, it's the most exciting educational conference I've ever been to. We had a comedian, we had food, we had wine. It was amazing. And it was about mental health, young people's mental health. Now, I happen to, that happens to be one of my areas, and I've studied it for a long time. But I was quite shocked by what they were proposing as the answers. And what they were proposing as the answers for schools is that schools should double their counselor load. And I thought, hang on a minute. Aren't schools about creating good mental health? Aren't schools about creating young people who strive hard, have some persistence, have good friendships? Shouldn't that be where we're putting our energy in creating a positive community in which young people can thrive, and we won't have these problems of mental health? And so that's what I mean by I see a very programmatic and fragmented response to the issues that young people have. And I see largely a medical, or in the VUCA world, an army model of things. So where's the educational response? Where's our innovation? Where's the innovation in teacher education? Where's the innovation in schools? Where we're really thinking and we're focused around the young people in those schools. Well, let me show you then, we're going up the path of enlightenment now. Let me show you, let me now turn to the London Challenge and turn to the theory of change that the London Challenge was based on. So it had a theory of change. David Hargreaves' theory of change. There was a partnership dimension, a professional development dimension, and a collaborative dimension. So, for example, in the London Challenge, schools were grouped in threes. They were trios of schools. They worked collaboratively together. And the idea was there was a range, if you like, of standard amongst those schools. And the idea was that everybody worked together to raise the performance of everybody. There were support systems. There was quite a big professional development element. There was a great program of support for head teachers. It was based on a theory of transfer of practice, which actually came out of a piece of work done at Sussex in 2005 with Michael Errow and colleagues, Michael Fielding as well. And here, Michael Fielding writes about the key principles, if you like. A social process that you transfer practice from one place to another. People learn about practice, that it's a social process that has to involve relationships and trust. It's a personal and interpersonal process that has to engage with our sense of teacher and institutional identity. It has to provide support for learner engagement in experimenting, and it has to be sustained over time. And it takes longer than expected, always. So here's a very different model. Here's another version of that model. Got many of the elements that we were looking at before about the elements on which current policy changes are focused on, making full use of data, close attention to narrowing gaps, accountability. So this is not a Yabu debate. Accountability is a good thing or a bad thing. It depends on how we do it. But built in was innovation, structural and radical solutions. Here's what the London Challenge describes as the DNA of the London Challenge. System leadership, collaboration, blah, blah, blah. You can all read. I don't need to talk those through to you. So again, a very different model of change to the one that I was showing you before. So this is the London Challenge. The Hutchins document is the evaluation of London Challenge. And this was their summation of what they've learned about innovation. Perhaps the most effective aspect of City Challenge was it recognized that people in schools tend to thrive when they feel trusted, supported, and encouraged. The ethos of the program, which successes were celebrated, and it was recognized that if teachers to inspire pupils, they themselves need to be motivated and inspired, was a key factor in the success. That challenge is now being tried in Wales. It started in Birmingham, it went to London, and it's now in Wales. Okay, so let's focus for a bit then on this notion of evidence and the evidence base and how it is created. I think I'm arguing that we need a range of evidence sources and questions, and that we have actually fallen into a preferred method. I'm not arguing against some of the questions that evidence raises. I think they're very important. I think what difference did it make as a question is an important one. As I have started to move into my new role and I've maybe advocated some things, I've been faced with policymakers who've said quite rightly to me, so what's the evidence? How do you know what difference it made? And I think what difference it makes includes looking at the people in the system. It includes looking at the process of innovation and change, some of the unintended consequences. So let me give you a classic example. I've been working for now 6-7 years in Kazakhstan, which is actually totally reforming its whole education system, post-Soviet state, independent for 20 years, making amazing progress. Biggest problem in Kazakhstan, which is the size of Western Europe, is the small rural schools. And how do you roll out a curriculum to Western Europe when you don't have the resources of the Soviet Union had, and these schools are not, they're still in many ways in another era. So one of the things that we've helped and they've done is to work on pedagogy. And I went out to one of these rural schools to ask to see how this first stage of the rollout was going and talk to these teachers in this very rural school. And the thing that really hit me was the unintended consequence of teacher motivation. We never set out to say this is going to transform teacher motivation. But the fact that these teachers could have a little bit more autonomy, and it wasn't much, but they could have more autonomy than they'd had before, had a revolutionary impact on them in terms of how professional they felt, how they felt that the fact that they could make some changes in their classroom and they had some autonomy and some choice had deeply impacted on them. So sometimes the unexpected things that we research are really, really important, the evidence we collect. Time scale is also key. And if you work in Kazakhstan, they do things 5 times as fast as anywhere else. So trying to say to people, look, this takes a long time and it's slow is really a hard message. But also there's no holy grail, even in evidence. So here have I stood here and said how wonderful the London Challenge was. And I did, in fact, have a graph in here that showed the increase, the claim, you know, the evaluation, and since it's been claimed that it made more progress, more difference in student attainment than any other program. What did I see this week? But this article in the press. The extraordinary success of London schools, typically credited to policies such as the London Challenge and introduction of academies, is more likely due to improvements in primary schools and local leadership. So I put that in there because that's the nature of evidence. There's always debate. There's always somebody saying, no, it wasn't that, it's this. But that makes us debate the issues, and it makes us think hard about our claims. And that's a very important thing to do. So Let me, in the last 5 minutes, just try and draw out some conclusions. I want to argue for innovation. I want to argue that innovation has become constrained, that change has constrained innovation. And I hope that we will start to see more innovation in schools, more innovation in classrooms, more innovation in teacher education, aimed at responding at depth to what we think the lives of young people are going to be like, the ones we're educating now. I desperately want that innovation to focus on authentic educational work and authentic educational needs, not just efficiency gains, not just financial gains, but actually, let's go and talk about how do our educational practices need to respond? How can we innovate with making teacher education a more satisfying task for students, our student trainee teachers? We have to care for the people in the system. We were talking at one of the other informal little conversations earlier was about Ryanair. And I sat in Stansted while I've never heard so many apologies from Ryanair over the loudspeaker as I heard my 2 hours at Stansted Airport on Tuesday night. Because in the end, how you treat people comes back to bite you. And so, you know, I do think we need to pay attention to the people in the systems, the people in the innovation, and so on. We have to work together. Teams, I'm going to show you in a minute something which shows the power of teams. We have to look at our organizations and our lives to see where we are creating spaces and conditions for innovation. Are we, in fact, doing the things that I put up as the local, the conditions that are needed or that we know enhance innovation? We need local practices, not just national policies and national practices, but we need local practices responding to local contexts and from which, if maybe we can scale up. But let's no longer be frightened of the local. We need consistent and varying evidence. We do need evidence, but we need a wide range, and we need different models of evidence collection, different types of evidence. But it's got to be fit for purpose. If I go back to that debate about the London Challenge, it's very, very difficult in education to say X equaled Y. So let's really not try to go down that line too much. And our measurement is not the only justification for innovation. In other words, don't stop innovating because you haven't measured something. I go back to that diagram there. You need a lot of things at the beginning to innovate before you start saying, I think I've got some evidence to... You do need evidence along the line, but I want to remind people that at the beginning you may have very little other than a lot of creativity. I thought I would finish because I happened to go to a presentation in my own university, which I don't do very much, on my own university, and it's apparently Cambridge City has become the third biggest innovation hub in the world. I'm not saying it's because of the university, but the university has actively encouraged this in the last decade or so. And I also want to say I haven't put the figures up, financial figures up, for the university. I just want to make clear the figures I'm showing you are not for the university. Cambridge University actually has an income of 1.3 million, no, 1.6 million, and it spends 1.3. So that's not exactly a large amount of money that is left over at the end. But there is this thing called the Cambridge Cluster. And it is a determination to create innovation. The university has actually done some things in terms of how it runs itself. For example, nobody can tell an academic what to do at Cambridge. So you have an expectation of what you're supposed to do and what you're supposed to teach. But after that, if you want to go off and set up your own business and experiment, you can. There is high autonomy at Cambridge, and there is high democracy, two things that people don't often associate with the university. Every major policy in the university is voted on by every academic. So what's the impact of this? This actually explained why house prices have gone up so much in Cambridge. There are 4,700 plus knowledge-intensive firms now in Cambridge, focused on knowledge. 60,000 people employed in them. There's only 18,000 people employed in the university. The turnover of the knowledge-intensive firms, knowledge-intensive, is £12 billion. So the Cambridge cluster, as it's known, has become the third most successful university innovation ecosystem in the world, next to MIT. 30% of people who live in CB1, which is in the center of Cambridge, work in knowledge-intensive industries. And there are 341.1 patents applied for per 100,000 residents. So what this is about, the reason I put this up, is because you can create the conditions for innovation. And there is a direct relationship between innovation, knowledge, and evidence. It's not a superficial relationship, it's a real relationship. Okay. Refreshments. Not yet, quite. What I've tried to do is to, provoke you into some thinking about innovation and education. So perhaps you just turn to the person next to you. What are the key things that it's provoked in you? And we'll stop there.